So they know the predictability. So if you've decided that, okay, you know, I'm going to ask both people, because I understand it might be unfair if I tell one of you to walk out. I'm going to ask both people to separate. I'm going to come in. I'm going to remind you of things that you can do to calm down your body. And then I would invite you to come back in when you feel like you're ready to. And if at that point we want to use words to talk about it, then that's cool. If not, I'm good with the fact that you re-regulated. And that's the biggest, if you come back into my room, I'm going to be proud of you. Because that shows that you're ready to be in this space. The words are not important to me. The fact that they regulated their body is important. And rejoin. They may come in the last 2 minutes. They might say it took me that long. In an ideal world, you would go out and like co-regulate with them and help them, remind them of the activities and maybe model the breathing or whatever. But you don't always have that luxury, especially if you're not co-facilitating with somebody else. So, I mean, in an ideal world, for people that don't know how to regulate at all, I co-regulate with them. So I will model it. I'll be like, I'll start doing the breathing, or I'll do the jumping jacks, or I'll do the expressive thing to discharge the energy. But it's also a good point, you know, to use with the rest of your group. Hey, you know what? Everybody gets angry. This is dysregulation. You know, what can we do? What do you do? What do you do if you're like that? What can we do? Here's something I do. You know, you can use it as a teaching moment too, depending on kind of where you're at with it. But what you don't want to do is to not attend to it and to let it spread. Because dysregulation spreads, and it spreads quick. Because as soon as somebody's aggressive, out of control, behaviorally, then everybody else goes into threat mode. So you're going to have to re-regulate your whole group, whether they want to admit it or not. So if you have a fist fight or a verbal fight in your group, you are going to have to stop whatever you're doing in your group and re-regulate, co-regulate the rest of the group too, even if those other two people leave. And it's a wonderful body teaching regulation moment to say, hey, how's your heart rate right now? Mine's sped up. You know, that made my heart beat faster.
So it's funny that I hear you talk about this, and then I just keep thinking about our women's group.
Yeah.
And how there's so much acting out in that group that we do. Because they're probably, at a lower level, like probably a 10-year-old at times.
Yeah.
And so, gosh, I'm really interested in like having more of those techniques for deregulation.
Yeah.
Because that's really, I know there was one time when someone like totally attacked me about something right in the middle of the class, and the whole class was in shock.
Yeah.
And we just didn't know what to do. It would have been amazing if we could have, you know, we just didn't know at the time what to do. But I think if we would have done like that was hard. Let's do, you know, something together.
And I think that's an important thing, right? This is when we go back to talking about you being able to do this stuff.
Yeah.
So important, right?
Yeah.
You got to figure out what works for you. If I know that, like, if everybody's becoming dysregulated, I might say, I've noticed that my heart's running faster right now. I'm just going to take a breath. Okay, that's a little better. I'm going to take another one. You guys are welcome to join me if you want, if that impacted you too. But right now, I need to get myself into my other side of the brain so that I can be with you again here. It's showing honesty of where your body is at. I might be, if I notice everybody's falling asleep, I might be like, hey, I'm getting tired. I don't know how anybody else feels, but I need to like wiggle. Anybody want to stand up with me? If you want to, you guys can stand up. You can wiggle your bodies. It's up to you. You don't have to. But I notice my body's tired right now. I have to do that because I know that I am the regulator of energy in that room. And I am also, unfortunately, due to circumstance, a permission giver. So I want them eventually to be able to do that themselves. So if they're becoming dysregulated, that I can see that they're using their good breathing, or they're, you know, whatever they need to do, or they've jumped up and down, or they're stretching their neck, or maybe doing some chair yoga, or whatever, you know, whatever it is that they're thinking. But I need to model it first. I need to show them how to do it. Because if I tell them how to do it and I don't show them, the chances of them actually really trying it are pretty small. I hate when we say, oh, let's teach them coping strategies. but then we never actively do them or model them for them. And so they're like, what the hell? Why would I want to use those? Like, you know, that's cool. What is that? What good does that do me? So part of that is tracking your own dysregulation during your groups, during your sessions, and being honest enough to say, that was heavy. That was, you know, I need to breathe that out. Or, you know, that touched me. I can feel that right here in my stomach right now. Does anybody else feel anything in their stomach? Where do you feel it? Oh, I feel it in my throat. You know, thinking about where we trap bodies in our emotion and where they sit with you. You know, I think that honesty of being in touch with your own body is something that everybody can do, and it will make your clients feel so much more connected and attuned to than they probably have been ever in their lives, especially if they have early developmental trauma where nobody has seen it. Nobody has seen their discomfort, their pain, their checking out, any of that. At first, are they gonna like it that you notice it? Probably not. But it means that you noticed it. And you may be the only person that's ever noticed and said something about the fact that they're twitching nonstop. How does that feel in your neck? What would it be like if we rolled it instead of twitched it? You know, and playing around with those type of things. And those are not things that, these are things that you do, and I know you mentioned being a mother, but these are things that you do in relationships. These are things that are our natural instinct to do. It's our natural instinct to model and to teach and to attune. That's what we're wired to do. That's what makes us feel safe. So these are not like things that you've never ever seen or never ever tried or never ever been part of. They may have been rare, but they're there. And this is what humans want. This is what we want. We want somebody to be able to attune to us, to feel heard, to feel understood, to feel listened to, and to be noticed. And it might be painful for some people, but it's also really cool. And it really brings them into a social world. And it changes the brain wiring. So, I mean, if we look at the normal brain of a 3-year-old child, there's shrinkage in loads of areas. So this is why you see this correlation between trauma and learning difficulties, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the difference between the brains.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you, are those two children the same age, and that's the actual size in mm-hmm. comparison to one another? Mm-hmm. So it's not that the normal kid's head is blown up and the mm-hmm. other one's head is mm-hmm. so that yeah. three that other
it's shrink it's literal shrinkage
is literally has a smaller yeah. skull, a smaller brain. Yeah.
Wow. Can you do anything to reverse that after your life?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can.
Isn't
like
cool?
You can make it get bigger?
Yeah. We can make brains get bigger and grown-ups too.
I love it.
That's why we like this. That's what's so cool about this neurobiology stuff that we're coming out with now is like therapeutically, we've known this for a long time, right? But now we got research behind it that can measure what the difference is before and after. Before, when a child's been homeless or been on the street, and then they get a good family that adopts them, and the way that the changes happen in the brain, and it's giving me chills. But to think about the memory, the language, the behavior, you know, that girl was talking about, the fact that you could be from a first grade level and in 2 years be doing algebra, just shows how much those areas of the brain are able to grow and what extent they're able to grow when safety and stability is created. Sorry, there was a question.
Yeah. I do have a question. So depending on the brain size, does that affect like your immune system as well
yeah.
or everything else?
Everything. Everything.
So someone who has been neglected could have more tendency of being sick?
Oh yeah. Asthma. Mm. Asthma is huge in pulmonary, all kinds of pulmonary and breathing difficulties, heart problems. The biggest thing, a lot of the kids that I see, huge digestive problems. And that's due to, you know, the vagus nerve, which goes down the back and connects the brain and the gut. It ends in the gut.
Mm.
So all of these digestive issues are from dysregulation and overstimulation of the nerve that carries the threat response. So it's, they're all correlated. And the idea is that, you know, the survival brain is what we're hardwired with. So it's where, you know, the cortisol and the adrenaline flood that leads to this fight, flight, or freeze. And our rational brain, like I talked about, goes offline. So we lose access to speech in those part of the brain. And this is kind of what I talked about earlier, is that everybody's level is different. So it's actually called, there's a nice formal word for it, which is the window of tolerance. But the nice spot is the spot in the middle. That's where we can be engaged, that's where we can be empathic, that's where we can connect with people, that's where we want to, you know, be in relationship. But then what we have is an upper hyperarousal zone and we have an under. So the hyper is your fight, flight, fright kind of flashbacks, all the increased sensation. And the hypo is where people cut off. So when we were talking about numbing out earlier, this is the numbed out. And you will see just as many in the hypo as you will in the hyper. Hyper tend to come to our attention because they're more out there with it. Hypo is quiet. It is checked out. It is flat face.
Disassociation.
100%. Right? Depression. A lot of hyper, you will see anxiety, you know, panic, that kind of thing. Hypo, you're gonna see a lot of severe depression, withdrawal, antisocial, some antisocial kind of behaviors that are not the necessarily acting out behaviors. So what everything we're trying to do is to pull people into the social engagement, that middle bit, that window of tolerance, the optimal arousal zone. So if people are in your group and you're interacting with them, these are some things that you might notice when they're kind of in one system versus the other. So a lot of us don't always pay attention to it, but a lot of, if you're working, especially one-to-one with somebody, and they're getting dysregulated, their pupil size changes. Their pupils dilate out. That's the body already doing the response before the brain might even know that the response is happening. I now, you know, I've worked with clients where I've seen them go huge. And they are no way aware that anything's happening. And I'll be like, you know, how do you feel right now? I feel fine. All right, let's get a little mirror. Can I show you what your pupils look like? Oh, well, actually, what you said really pissed me. You know, so you get an interesting dialogue, but these are like body responses, right? Decreased secretion, so like dry mouth, like, you know, that like feeling parched, that kind of feeling, that's the sympathetic nervous system. Increased heart rate. So again, I will often have people check heart rate because I think that's an easier one to do. You can have them do up here, and if everybody can feel, pulse is hard, I can't get my own pulse, but this is a good one. So they can check where they're at. I always, when I introduce like a relaxation activity, have them check before and after. It's really cool. If you're working one-to-one with people, get the little blood like the little finger monitors. Biofeedback is awesome, especially if somebody is so disconnected with their body they can't track anything. Then you can see, and you can see the difference. Increased blood pressure, heavy breathing, bowel activity. You might get people that feel uncomfortable in your class and, you know, have to run to go to the bathroom all the time. You might get people that never go to the bathroom, but it's something to kind of track as a pattern of health. And then the parasympathetic is going to be all the things that take things down. So the sympathetic is going to be taking things up, parasympathetic takes things down. And so we're looking for balance, and that's the key thing that you're looking for. You cannot do these heavy level thinking pieces, worksheets, cognitive things until you are balanced. So this is something to keep in mind as you do this work. When people are out of balance, you're going to see things called adaptations and mitigations. And those occur in the body to help protect. So all of the behavioral things that you're seeing that are maladaptive behaviors in most of your clients are from overuse of the threat response in the body trying to make up for it in the best way it knows how. So So these are the sympathetic nervous system. Most important things, and we talked about more about the body things, but the thinking effects on the sympathetic nervous system. No future, impulsive, irrational and illogical. No plan outside of immediate activity. Little self-reflection, little evaluation. So if somebody is in the sympathetic nervous system, you'll be able to tell, because when you're talking to them, if they have access to language, these are the type of things that you're gonna see in terms of their responses. It means they're activated. They might not be bouncing off the wall, they might not have their heart rate through the roof, but they're activated, because this is where the brain goes when it's activated. Even if it does have access, and your clients are older, they're not gonna shut off as quickly as mine from verbal. You still might get verbal, but these are the kind of verbal kind of things you're gonna get, not the full, not what you'd like to be working with. And our window of tolerance is reflected in our ability to cope, and it can be smaller. Window of tolerance sometimes impacted by other coping strategies, including drugs, smoking, sexual promiscuity, drug use. And you might see behavioral symptoms that include jumpiness, defiant behavior, withdrawal, inability to focus, and lack of trust. So if we think about resilience, the effects of trauma can last a lifetime, but they don't have to. So there's ways to buffer the effects of trauma and build resilience. And nurturing relationships are crucial. So you always want to find out who people have in their life. They might have nobody. They might have one person. They might have a lot of people. And what those relationships look like. Who they can trust. Can they trust anybody? Because it lets you know where they're coming into their relationship with you. If they have nobody and they've never trusted anybody, you're working with a different set than somebody that actually trusted somebody and lost them, trusted somebody and they breached their trust. You know, you're looking at a different set of relational kind of needs. You're still going to approach it the same way, but you're also going to hold that in mind. You're going to hold that in mind as you think about them, as you cater things towards them, as you treat. So we start with the body, and we think about how the body is coming into your time together. How does their body feel as they come into the session? You can do a body rating scale. You can do a check-in. You can do a body check-in. You can say, you know, where are you at right now? Like, how's today been? Like, you know, do you feel tension? One way to show that the system is activated is also holding tension. Thinking with them how they identify tension. Where do you identify tension? Mine sits in my jaw. I know that if my jaw is getting tight or I'm clenching, something's going on, whether I want to believe it or not. Other people hold it in their neck. Other people hold it in their feet. It just depends on the person. So identifying, first of all, where you hold tension and thinking about that and how you release that tension, or whether you don't attend to it and you ignore it. It's another interesting thing.
So for me personally, like sometimes, like even right now, I just feel nervous or anxious.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, why am I feeling, you know, like this? So like sometimes I'll have like moments and it's kind of like draining, just trying to figure out where it's coming from, you know?
Yeah.
So like how would I be able to handle that? Like where, like, cause sometimes I just have random moments where I'm like, my anxiety is like, I'm like having to take deep breaths and it feels like, I don't know what the issue is, but I know I just feel some type of way.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So like
100%.
How do you, if you're with a client, like, and they're just kind of randomly just feeling like that, like how would I go about that, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So it doesn't really matter to me where it comes from until we've dealt with it.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing is that we deal with it, right? So whether how we process where it comes from comes after. So if I have somebody that is feeling tense, they're telling me that they're feeling tense, I can see the tension in their body. Sometimes I have people, especially kids, like this, where I can see it. I will invite them to see what it would be like to do the opposite behavior. I would model it. So people may or may not like this, but I would say, you know, I notice that your shoulders are a little bit up high. I wonder how they feel. How do your shoulders feel? They feel tense, or I don't like it. You know, they feel tight or whatever. then I might say, what would it feel like if we dropped them? I might notice that your breathing is a little tight and, you know, you're not taking deep breaths. And I might say, yeah, what would it be like if we took a couple of breaths together? So it's inviting to take care of the body. The idea is that you will introduce enough activities to begin with, or ideas or strategies, that when somebody is coming in this body state, and if you notice or they notice, that they can attend to it. And to teach people that they can't do good learning, good work, until their bodies are relaxed. Because you're on edge, right? Then, after I do that piece, if we want to, we can explore where it came from. But for me, if the body's relaxed at that point, I don't need to. I mean, I have the same attitude towards trauma therapy. I'm going to teach everybody how to control and regulate their body and use their frontal lobe and develop these skills. I don't really need to know their trauma story if we're doing all these things and we're functioning good. Because it means in the present, we're taking care of it. We're taking care of business. However, people usually at the end of their piece of work will want to go back and do the why piece. But I think that threat is important. So I would say, somebody says they're feeling nervous. I would first work on calming the body. And then I might ask if I was going to address it, or they wanted to address it, what in the room makes you nervous? Somebody might say, people are looking at me. Somebody might say, you know, I feel like you're going to talk about something I don't understand. You're telling me something I don't want to know. You know, there's lots of different reasons why people can feel nervous. I saw that person out last night, and they were doing something that we're not supposed to be doing. You know, like, it could be because, you know, you're working with people in the same community. You know, so-and-so said they're sober, but I saw them out getting high. You know, like, these are, like, the reality of, you know, they're not being honest. That makes me mad. I want to go punch them. You know, like, this is the reality of what you're working with, right? And these are dysregulated. These are people that have been in a constant state of dysregulation. So somebody coming in and lying in the group, that's a threat. That's going to make them on edge. That's going to make them edgy. The fact that you said you were going to do something and you didn't do it, and you don't have an excuse and you haven't attended to it, they might be mad at you. So these are all things that are important to keep in mind as you do the work. And calling attention to it. The last thing you want to do is to let somebody sit in it. They've had enough time sitting in this. That's been probably most of their lives. Sitting in chronic dysregulation. Sitting in emotions that they either swallow or they throw up on somebody else. You know, so this is, you're trying to create a different kind of pattern and model. And sometimes people like to use, like, the example of the Hulk. So, you know, you have Bruce Banner, who's, like, super smart and a scientist and wonderful. And then you have him go into, when he gets dysregulated, when he's triggered, into Hulk brain, which is smash it up, pure defense fight mode, right? And then you have re-regulation back into. So if you wanted to show, like, a cool, like, movie example, totally show the Hulk. Find a clip where there's an emotional dysregulation, where he feels like mistrusted or he feels like somebody's cheating. I think there's a few ones, like interactions with him with other people. Find one of those and show it. And say, this is real. It doesn't look like this because you're not green, but it's real. This is what is happening in your brain. And it's kind of a cool example of it, especially if you're doing it as a psychoeducation teaching piece. Like, hey, I want to show you a cool movie that kind of, like, shows how your brain works, like, how the brain works. And you can show it, and somebody be like, yeah.
We actually did something like that. Yep. Most of our kids that come in sleep on the streets all the time. Yep. They're dealing with police officers. They don't get enough sleep because they're always up all night because they're dealing with, I don't want to get robbed, which a lot of people do. I want to get raped. I don't want to get hurt. Yep. I don't want to get jumped. And a lot of times when they come in, they're so upset. And with the previous thing you said, a lot of times when they're holding group, well, no, hey, last night I just saw you getting high. What are you talking about? You're sober.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times I've had kids flip over tables. They just lose it. And Fridays we have movie days, and we play the Hulk. And all the kids are, hey, that was you the other day.
Yeah.
And they see that within themselves. That they even call themselves out, and they pat themselves back too. Yeah, I don't have to do that anymore. You're right. Yeah. I did do that. And a lot of times, sometimes we just, you know, plant the seed and let them take care of it, and before, you know, you all you know, they start doing it themselves and they help themselves. So yeah, they definitely go into foolish manner and Hulk all the time. And there are some clients in there that will calm the other ones down.
Yeah.
And there's some that definitely escalate the other ones and push those buttons. So it's definitely interesting, yeah.
And you know, observe, have them observe it. Like, who makes you kind of move out of Hulk brain? Mm-hmm. Who doesn't?
Sometimes
who pushes you into it?
Right, because we have the whole group and we'll have 20 kids in there at a time. And it could be pretty fine, and that one person comes in and
yeah.
we already know, okay,
yeah.
he's gonna get everybody to that point. And it happens.
Yeah. And I think that I can't remember which one, I think it's the Age of Ultron or something like that, the new one of the newer Avengers movies. There's a point where Thor is trying to talk down.
Thor Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good clip.
I'm that special kind of nerd. I know
yeah.
exactly.
That, well, you know what is funny is I was thinking about that because I was thinking about who he tries to talk him down.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing piece to show young people because Thor is trying to use these abilities to talk the Hulk down to get Hulk back into rational brain.
The thing is, he it starts off where he sets him off because
yes.
Banner realizes that Hulk's trying to manipulate him to be the Hulk, and then when he's about to like lose it, Thor flips and goes, no, it's cool, you know, we're good, you know, don't go green and kill everybody, you know. So
mm-hmm.
it kind of actually goes through that entire cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good piece, and it's a little bit more, it's a little newer than the other original ones, but it's a good piece. Anytime you have a psycho education piece, throw some of this stuff in there if it's going to work for your groups, because it makes it relevant. It makes it, and it also takes it out of them. It's so much easier for them to observe somebody else doing it, and then to understand the science behind it, than to think about them doing it. If they're in defense mode because you're talking about them, when you're talking about this brain stuff, they're not gonna listen to you. But if they watch the Hulk thing and then you talk about the brain thing, then they can go, oh, you know, hey, that's kinda like, you know, like they can connect it. So you think about that as you do that. Is it gonna make them be able to step out of, you know, how they feel and then make a connection later? That's fine. I don't need them to say, I am like the Hulk, you know? I need them to understand the way that the brain, what's happening in the brain during this time. And then if they want to connect that with them or the person next to them because they don't want to connect that with them, and then that next week they notice that actually, oh man, they went Hulk. You know, that's cool. That's good. I'm totally fine with that. We don't need to push people out of their window straight away. We're trying to keep them in the window so they can see. So it's okay to be protective in terms of not putting people on the spot. And not making it feel like therapy. I think that's important. So being stuck in dysregulation is where we see the symptoms. That's where the symptoms come from. So there's some stuff about the amygdala, and it's about, you know, protecting and projecting. But I'm gonna skip through that to go to the, and you can read that later. The symptoms not working together, we kind of talked about this, and that there's difficulty sitting quietly within yourself, there's difficulty tuning into body sensations. So people might be shut off from their body. That is a normal trauma response. When you ask somebody, like, you know, how it feels in their body, they might have no idea. And that's okay. That's okay. You're just bringing it up. By the end of your work together, they might be able to know when something bothers them in their body, and that's okay. Again, it's to protect themselves. So, how do we get shift to happen? Well, shift happens on its own in your classes, in your groups, in your life, right? But what do we see? So what do we see when shift is happening within states? So an extreme example is the Hulk, but we might see some of these other things. So these are called adaptive and mitigating behaviors. And these are designed to keep the brain and body safe too. So this is what you might see. Anger and aggression, inattention, sleep disturbances, fidgeting, hyperactivity, anxiety, irritability, delays in reaching milestones, defensive, reactive, impulsive, hostile, irrational, self-centered, and poor focus. I'm sure everybody's seen these in the people that they're working with or in themselves when they're dysregulated. So these are some of the adaptive responses. We see labeling, global labeling. And I, the reason why we go through these is so you know that when you hear one of these, that they're in a position of dysregulation, that this is where they're coming from. And they may not be out of control, but this is the way that the brain has wired things. And it might become so used to saying things and doing things this way that that's the way they function. They don't function out of this adaptive response mode. This is where they're at. So all you men and women are alike. That's not a good job. You did that bad. If it weren't for you, we'd be in this place or someplace else. That's it. I've had it. Forget it. Stop it. If you don't shut up right now, this is your last chance, or I'm not coming back. Probably more and so in the groups. I know what you're doing. I know what you're trying to do. I notice, oh, this is another one. I notice that the dishes haven't been done. This is kind of the passive aggressive one that you might see more in relationships, especially for us. You used to look good, but now I'm embarrassed to be seen with you, like humiliation. Get out of here, I'm tired of looking at you. And they're doing it for attention. Now these are the kind of behaviors, the mitigating behaviors that go with it, whining. So trying to get a need met without assertiveness, flatness, cold and frosty tone, mocking and contentious tone, looking away or looking at the floor, frowning, needs immense amounts of reassurance, shrugging shoulders, moving or turning away, appearing disinterested, does not have any interests or favorite activities, did not look happy, fatigued, listless expression, does not do much to solve a problem. So you might look at these two lists and say, am I a mitigator or do I do more adaptive responses? People are different, even healthy people. You're always gonna go into these because everybody gets dysregulated. So I know for me, I'm more of a mitigator. I'm more of a dissociator. I'm not the other side, which is more confrontational and more kind of in the hyper-aroused zone, but everybody's different. I think it's important that you, if you're going to introduce us, that you think about what you are, but also, you know, allow people the space to say, you know, I definitely do that. Or, no, I don't do that one, but I do that one. Or I'm a little bit of both. So what is stability? Well, stability is when the brain is linked and different parts of work are working together. So people that come into your groups are going to have activators. So we also often refer to them as triggers. First thing I would do is think about your triggers. What triggers you? What triggers you in working with other people? What triggers you in relationship? And then we also need to think about the triggers or the activators that somebody that's experienced trauma might be coming in with. These are big things. And they might go on nonstop every day. They might come in and out. They might only come in certain situations. But just be aware that there are lots of basic unmet human needs that are activated by the environment. And, you know, somebody that comes into your group might have all of these, even though they're not something that you've experienced. So we're going to go into, I'm going to play a little video on resilience, but I'll just quickly kind of run through these before we go into more detail on each one. So there's been lots of research around resilience. The research around resilience really came out of research around stress. Also came out of research around happiness, also came out of research around how traumatized people are able to move forward and be successful in life. So we call that skill and that ability to kind of be resilient. I've started talking a lot about self-regulation. Self-regulation for me is not the mind controlling the body, but it's being able to attend to the body and be able to provide things to calm the body down. And if your people with you only learn one thing, or you only learn one thing, I would say that the one thing that you should model and learn is self-regulation. All this other stuff comes after the body's regulated, but it's equally important. So perceptual maturation, that's kind of like the way you look at the world. Connection and support, that's building the relationships with you and with other people, maybe other people in the group, but might not be you at all. It could be that you're connecting with other people. Self-care and revitalization. So how are they looking after themselves? Not when they're dysregulated, but just generally. Like, what is the level of self-care? What is the level of checking in and taking care of themselves? And intentionality. So, like, what are their intentions? Where are they, how do they look at life? Like, what are they, what is the plan? Like, they have this journey that happened to get them to where they are right now. Where are they going? How are they going to get forward? What is their goal? How do they want to live their life? When you've done an ACE score and you look at that, how does that make you feel? Does that make you feel like, I don't want to ever experience this again? I am never going to do this. Or does it make you feel like we're all doomed to do this? You know, like, how does the intention, how do we shift intentionality? And that's super important. So I'm gonna show a
Can you explain what number two is a little bit more?
Yeah, so that's perceptual maturation, is really thinking like how you frame the world. Like how you look at things, whether you look at things as positive or negative. So I'm going to show you a few different videos that you can actually introduce with clients that kind of target on these. I might not use these words, depending on, you know, what age, cognitive level, whatever. I'm using them for you so that, you know, you guys as professionals know what they are. And if you hear the jargon or the terminology, self-regulation, I think you can use, but you can also use it as like, you know, body control. You know, you don't have to use self-regulation. If you don't like that word. What?
Self-awareness?
Well, it's body awareness. So I would say you can do body awareness, yeah. I think that I don't like to use the word calming because some people need to be upregulated. So this is an important piece, especially if you're working with disassociative or people that where you get a lot of energy dips. You're not necessarily always working on calming the body. Sometimes you're working on bringing the body out of the lower level into balance. So it's not always bringing down from the hyper level. And I think, unfortunately, we always talk about like relaxation. But there's some people that are so relaxed they're about to pass out. Like their systems chill. They need to come into living. They need to come into energy presence. That's a different thing, right? So that's why I don't use calming activities or relaxation as the title, because I don't want to insinuate that everybody's trying, that coming into their middle space is relaxing. Coming into their middle space might be upregulating. So that's an important piece. But you can use whatever words you like for these two. I don't think that there's a right or wrong way. So I'm just gonna pull up the video. I have to put on my glasses because like the ones on the side are like so small. Oh no, I'm gonna do another one. Yeah. So here's these are super short too. And you might, as you watch these, there might be one that you're like, oh, that's lame. And there might be like one, hey, that's good, I like it. So I'm gonna show you, they're like about 2 minutes each. I'll show you a few of them. Maybe not all of them, but we'll show some of them. So I'm going to show you first this positive and negative thinking one. So when we talk about the way that perception, like perceptual maturation and thinking about like the way that people perceive the world, I like this one.
Thank you.
like that's less than 2 minutes, but it shows you the brain and the perceptual way that people might come into relationships, into situations, and then the ability to see that. The first time you watch that video, you might not have noticed all the other things that the other person thinks, and the second side of it. Because we're guided by what we're taught. We're guided by the narrative that everybody else has. And perceptual change is based on changing that, is based on looking for positive. And that's what you're gonna have to do with every person that you work with, is you're going to have to look for the flip side of that and model looking for that with them. Because they might not have ever seen the other side of thinking about a situation. Could be nobody's ever modeled that for them. And that's the same thing with positive thinking. I like that one because it's the same image in both. So it shows them the same image of both. Whereas sometimes if I use word reframing, it doesn't really kind of tap in the same way. Like, how do we think about that in a positive way? Like, how do we reframe that positively? Well, that's an image, and it's the same image in both. It's just a different way of looking at things. The other way you can do this is you can pause it between each one and say, what do you see before it comes up with something? And then show them the video all the way through and show them the different responses. And this is the difference between positive and negative thinking.
I felt like the music was also very indicative.
Mm-hmm.
The first set had very intense, strumming music, just single.
Yeah.
It felt like you're moving toward a bad end, where the other was much lighter. And I was thinking that's so much about what's in the background of our lives. You know,
100%.
The voices we hear,
the
things that are happening that either give us the ability to see things in a positive light, to see that other image.
That's right. So this is another one that I'm going to show you that's kind of along the same lines about like the way that you think of things. And they have lots of these little stories. And if you have a limited reading group, I would read this out loud to them, kind of like a story. Thank you. have a similar thing. I would encourage you, especially if you're working with different cultural groups, try and find stories that appeal to people. Myths are great for this. Cultural stories that are within, you know, their own culture that represent morals. They will remember a story more than they will remember your lecture. You might remember the beans, the coffee beans, and the eggs more than you remember anything I told you about the nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous system. That's good. That's fine, right? This is what we're trying to do. You want to have stuff that sticks. Stories, music, images, they stick. They stick in a different way, and they meet a little bit less resistance, generally. If they feel like everybody has nothing good to say, you're just another voice to begin with until you build a relationship. But something you might show them like this might stick. So that one's kind of simple, but there's lots of different versions. There's one where there's actual like real people. So just something to think about as you're doing that piece. The other piece that I really like to do with that is thinking about, and I'm showing you the Pinterest board here, is thinking about famous failures. Thinking about the different people that have had challenges, who have faced adversity, that are people that are successful. That's that modeling card that that boy showed about looking at people as models. So we look at Albert Einstein. He was not able to speak until he was 4 years old, and his teacher said that he would never amount to much. Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team, and he went home and locked himself in the room and cried. Walt Disney was fired from a newspaper for lacking imagination and having no original ideas. Steve Jobs, at 30 years old, he was left devastated and depressed after being unceremoniously removed from the company he had started. Oprah Winfrey was demoted as her job from news anchor because she wasn't fit for television. And the Beatles were rejected by Decca Recording Studios, who said, "We don't like their sound, and they have no future in show business." So I think that the more you show these model stories, and pick what's relevant for your people, pick what's relevant for your client group, but the more we show model stories that are safe stories, that don't have to be personal, don't have to be close to you, these can be other people's stories. They don't have to be these, you know, these stories that we're sharing from other people, but they show big success. And especially young people, they like big success. So like they're gonna be more into hearing about somebody like Michael Jordan then they are probably going to be into hearing about your success and the fact that you went to college, even though that's really cool and it's great. You know, like you have to think, you have to go big with these things, right? Sometimes to get noticed with these. And think about whose success stories you tell, because they're not impressed as much as we are with kind of academic achievements generally.
Although sometimes I feel like we have to be realistic.
Yeah, I would do both. But I think that, you know, yeah, I think
sometimes they wanna like now, especially you know, there's like these rich YouTubers, rich, you know, or you know, they like Michael Jordan has a very special gift, you know, and then so if you don't necessarily have those skills, you might not, you know, make it there. I mean, it's great to aspire to those things, and if you work hard or you have a skill or whatever it is that you choose to do, but I think if they define success on their own, like what success means to them, my definition of success is gonna be different from his or yours. Or
and that's that intentionality piece. So that is a part of this. Like, what would success look like for you? This is what success looks like for other people. Success might be something simple. It might be being able to get a job, like a simple job, and hold it down and be able to get a paycheck, get the first paycheck. You know, it might be to be able to have, you know, successful housing. It might be able to drink only 2 days a week, not 5 days a week or 7 days a week. You know, like these things, are these goals, you want to have big goals, because if you don't dream big, you're never going to get any bigger than where you're at. But you also want to have micro goals. So when we look at intentionality and we look at goal setting with people, we really need to look at big goals, inspirational goals, and then we take it down. And we take it down. And we take it down. I think one of the biggest failures we do is we give people these huge goals, just like you said. Not necessarily like Michael Jordan goals, but we might give a big goal. It's too big. Right now, I need daily success. I need weekly success. I need monthly success. Then I'm gonna build. but I always lay it all out. I don't limit to these little goals. I put the big ones on there too, because I want them to see where we're leading, where we're going, where the journey's headed. So if the goal is college and we've dropped out of high school, we got some little steps. And then we're gonna get there. But this is how we attempt to do it. When you do a big goal with no little steps, they fail and then they give up. If you do lots of little goals with no big goal, then you really don't know where you're heading. And a lot of them have had enough experience, and a lot of us have had a lot of experience of not knowing where you're going, just getting by on a daily day basis. And you might improve your just getting by. The just getting by might look a little bit better, but let's go bigger than that. Let's move from sobriety to job stabilization to, you know, career goals to family goals, whatever's important to you. I mean, for some people, it might be the biggest, most important thing in their life is not to pass on trauma to their kids. It might be not to be an abuser. It might be not to be a user. Whereas the person next to them might have a totally different way that they want to go with that. So it's important to honor all of that and to provide a space for all of that. And you know, it's contagious. When somebody sets a big goal in a group, sometimes you'll see the other goals kind of creep up a little bit because they're kind of like, kind of like the sound of that. And it could be something they never thought of before. So that's a beautiful thing of sharing things within groups. So sometimes you get things that are contagious that are really good things in terms of goal setting. And somebody might say, I want to do that and this. Okay, let's look at our journeys. What do they look like? What do they look like as we break them down? How do we intentionally work towards that every day? What is our intention when we get up in the morning? What are we telling ourselves? Is it today I'm going to exercise instead of drinking? Is it today I'm going to try to say hello to people and be more friendly? Is it, you know, whatever it may be, it's that daily intention that builds up to bigger things. Most people that have had really adverse experiences or are living on the street are very much based in their immediate needs. So moving into the realm of thinking beyond the immediate needs is going to be very foreign. And the intentionality is going to look a little bit different. But you need to adjust to where your people are at. So if you're teaching people about resilience, there's lots of different tools. Here's the five.
Have you ever heard people say, think positive, get your head in the game, have a healthy attitude? What does it even mean? To explain, let's take something we all know, like a phone. They're getting smarter, just like you. And as the adverts keep telling us, everything about them is connected. Which is true, everything is connected. Your physical, your mental, and your emotional health and well-being. All of them affecting each other and affecting you. Life's about finding balance. But how do we even do that? Well, the first bit's obvious. You've got to have charge. Sleep is essential for your body and brain to rest, regulate, and repair. About 9 hours to be properly charged up. Good morning. Next up, a phone is meant to be used for communication. Sharing. Sharing and talking help staying connected. We're the same. Life's so much better when we're connected to our friends, family, and community. Your attitude will also improve when you learn and achieve new things. Set yourself a goal. Be faster, jump higher, expand your grasp of a new subject, or master the art of pancake flipping. There you go. You'll surprise yourself with what you can do and the feeling of reaching your goal, like the tastiest pancakes. When it comes to emotions, don't repress it, express it. get creative, and explore those feelings through art, music, whatever. If it all gets too much, remember to be present in the moment. Shut off the what ifs and distractions. Take some time to just be. So when you put it all together, getting in charge, staying connected, setting goals, expressing yourself, and knowing when to take time out, you'll find that you're a lot more protected against the bumps and knocks of life, so you can carry on being awesome.
Five ways. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Resilience, but what is it? Here's five ways to build resilience.
Five ways to.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, my favorite part of that is the part about pancake flipping. And I'll tell you why. We want them to have success. When you are structuring activities for your group, especially in the beginning, live them little opportunities to have success. That might be building a tower out of cups and seeing who can build the highest tower. It might be having a little activity where they are able to make something that's super easy, that you know they're going to be successful. You want to give opportunities to get small successes. That small success on that day might mean so much more than you would ever imagine. That boy teaching those kids how to be able to do that trick on that skateboard was huge. So when you are developing your groups, your plans, your sessions, whatever you're doing, figure out ways for them to be successful in your group, to be praised on, for other people to notice their success. Make the task so easy that there's no way they can fail. And interestingly enough, you know what they'll start asking for?
Harder stuff.
Harder stuff. Because they will build on that feeling of being successful. Track it. When you give them that easy task and they're successful and they're proud of it, praise it and track it. How does that feel right now? I can see you're smiling. That's awesome. This is what it feels like. This is what it feels like to not fail. Look at this. It's pretty cool, huh? And very rarely will you have somebody that says it sucks to be successful on a small task. It could be that there's something that they know that somebody else doesn't know. It could be that you invite people once they feel comfortable or safe in a group to teach a new skill. Hey, can you, you know, it can be anything. You can tell them. You can teach us anything. Not how to load a pipe or something that's going to get your people in trouble if you're users, but something that is appropriate for your group that they can teach how to do. Maybe someone knows how to braid, knows how to cornrow. I mean, who knows? Whatever. Everybody has something. And if they don't, that's okay. Watch what everybody else has and think about something you'd like to learn. And bring that into your group. It can be simple. It can be like little food prep, like making pudding. I mean, that's easy. You can't mess that up. You measure it out. You have it all measured for them. They make it. They get to taste it. They get to enjoy it. You can do something really simple. It does not have to be big. And that's the important thing about it.